Hello, and welcome to the St Albans and District Talking Newspaper, serving St Albans, Harpenden and surrounding villages. This is the News Extra edition for the week ending Saturday, the 28th of July, 2018. My name is Steve, but today's programme is being produced on my behalf by Liz Ann and Alex, so many thanks to them. In this programme, we'll have our usual roundup of news stories from this week's Hearts Advertiser, followed by our selection of some good bits of national radio coming up in the next few days. After that, we have another in our series of Community Matters interviews with a local charity. Today's music is called Trombone Hustle and is by Goffby. So we start with the news.
Hi, I'm Nick Clark, and the first article I'm reading is entitled Incinerator to Fuel Airport. Campaigners are fighting proposals for a new incinerator on Harpenden and Kimpton's doorstep to fuel Luton Airport's expansion. Energy company Emsrain will be applying to Central Bedfordshire Council for permission to build the Lee Bank Energy Park at New Mill End, north of Harpenden and west of Kimpton. It would work 24/7 and could produce up to 50 megawatts of heat and 49.99 megawatts of electricity. However, instead of supplying nearby Hertfordshire, Emsrain want to power to fuel new developments in and around Luton Airport, as well as homes and businesses in the local area. A spokesperson for Luton Borough Council, who owned the airport, said, "To clarify, this proposed development is not connected to or developed on behalf of London Luton Airport. This is a private developer. We have been approached by Central Bedfordshire Council as part of their consultation on the proposals, and while we are yet to take a formal position, we can confirm a combined heat and power plant are at odds with the Council's own energy strategy and vision, which is based on solar and wind generation. However, this is clearly a matter for our neighbouring authority. Our airport company has confirmed, if the scheme were to be approved, there is potential for the airport to be among those who could benefit from this additional source of power, but could only be supportive if environmental impacts were kept to a minimum. The potential environmental impact is also troubling residents in surrounding villages. Tim Armstrong-Taylor, for the Stop the Harpenden Luton Incinerator Group, also known as SHLT, said, "It's going to make everyone's lives miserable. We are trying to make people aware of it, as it is something that has no need to be there." The Kimpton father of three says the UK will need to dispose of 10.4 million tonnes of waste by 2030. But it already has the capacity to dispose of 14.9 million, with a further capacity for 4.9 million tonnes under construction. This will mean the UK will have the capacity to dispose of 9 million more tonnes of waste than it needs to, even without this new incinerator. We will have to import waste from abroad, and not only will we be putting carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, there will be lorry jams as well. According to SHLT, the plant will be 15 stories high, as big as Harpenden High Street, and will burn 500,000 tonnes of residual waste, non-hazardous material left over from the recycling process, every single year, which campaigners worry will create CO2. Kimpton Parish Council has given SHLT £500, and Hitchin and Harpenden MP Bim Atholami is also opposed to the proposals. He said, "From damaging environmental effects to huge traffic congestion, the plethora of issues gives me little hope this proposal is beneficial to the area in which we live. I cannot see any positive impact to the plans for Hertfordshire residents. I have been working closely with SHLT. We met last Friday to discuss our next steps and have compiled a list of questions gathered through public consultation to ask Emsrain, the builders of the incinerator. I also attended the public launch of this new report, published by United Kingdom Without Incineration Network, on waste incineration at the House of Lords. It gave me a great deal of insight into the national policy surrounding waste incineration. I will continue to work with all parties to ensure no incinerator is built in this area. A spokesperson for Lee Bank Energy Park says the plant will allow them to extract energy from materials which would not be recycled anyway. Libby Forrest from the Environmental Services Association said, "Energy for Waste, or EFW, is one of the most tightly regulated combustion processes. Its emissions limit for particulate matter is amongst the lowest applied to any industry. EFW plants continuously monitor particulate matter, which captures PM10 and PM2.5, which is reported to and independently verified by the Environment Agency. Results show that the average EFW operates well below the emissions limit."
Hello, Jean here. I'm now carrying on with the incinerator theme, reading now the Hearts Ad comment, "What We Think." "The spectre of an incinerator is once again overshadowing the district. Only instead of the scheme once mooted for New Barnfield, not far from the Coneys, this time the proposal is for a site on the doorstep of Harpenden. The project, which will be unquestionably a blot on the landscape at 14 stories high, has shocked neighbouring residents, many of whom were not notified, and a campaign group has sprung up to fight it. The implications for a scheme of this size are far-reaching and should be a concern to everyone who lives in the district, not just the residents of Harpenden. We must be aware of the associated risks of pollution, but also the infrastructure required, which could bring hundreds more lorry movements onto the surrounding roads. Lorries will arrive or depart from the facility a staggering 24 times an hour, and the developers are actually in talks about widening the Lower Harpenden Road to accommodate, as well as reducing the speed limit and introducing turning spaces. So, not only is this incinerator going to belch fumes into the atmosphere, which the right wind could scatter anywhere in the district, but it's going to transform a pleasant country road into a major thoroughfare, with adjacent land lost to allow for the widening. It's no wonder residents are spitting feathers at the thought. Of course, the developers have come up with the usual spiel about why nobody should worry about their lovely big incinerator, as it's going to be used to fuel the expansion of Luton Airport, something else nobody really wants. Local MP Bim Afolami has pledged that he will be fighting to prevent this project from going ahead, and we look forward to seeing how he tackles this challenge over the coming months. This is the beginning of what is sure to be a long and protracted battle, and the Hearts Ad will be supporting the fight against this monstrosity every step of the way.
Hello, my name is Leslie. The headline on my first article is "The Photos What He Took, Lost Pictures of Eric Morecambe from Snapper's Collection." A lost archive of unseen photos featuring comedy genius Eric Morecambe have been published for the first time. The gallery of images were taken by the late newspaper photographer Tony Greg Gregory and feature the funny man at the height of his powers. They can be seen exclusively on our sister website Enjoy Harpenden More, which launched this week. They feature many pictures in the company of his professional partner, Ernie Wise, including shots of them performing on stage at St Albans City Hall, now the Auburn Arena. The legendary Morecambe lived in Harpenden from the 1960s until his death in 1984, during which time he was a regular sight around the town and nearby St Albans. He and Greg became good friends, and Eric was regularly featured within the pages of the Hearts Advertiser. After the chief photographer passed away in 2013, Hazel, his wife of 20 years, returned a collection of his prints and negatives to the newspaper, including his Morecambe archive. They included Eric and his family admiring the new-look tabloid-sized Hearts ad and the marriage of his daughter Gail. Due to the nature of press photography during the 1970s and 80s, which often only required a single image for use, many of the pictures have never been printed before now. Eric's legacy lives on in Harpenden, with the town's public halls named after him and his portrait hanging in the foyer. A metal silhouette of the comedian can also be found on the Lee Valley Walk between Luton and Harpenden. St Albans actor Bob Golding appeared as Eric in Tim Whitnall's play Morecambe, which he performed before members of the comedy legend's family on the stage of the Alban Arena in 2014. He was overjoyed to see these new pictures made available for the first time. What a fantastic collection of pictures of the ultimate British double act. Thank you for sharing them. It is nice to know that our local hero Eric is still bringing such sunshine even 34 years after his passing, the true meaning of a legend. And there are lots more photographs, including one of Eric and Ernie in their heyday and others of Eric around St Albans and Harpenden, including one of him with a troop of Boy Scouts.
Hello, I'm Lizanne. My first article has the title, More Than 1,000 Women Don Their Running Shoes to Paint Park Pink. More than 1,400 women went pink in the heatwave to support the fight against cancer at this year's St Albans Race for Life. Organisers Cancer Research UK thanked everyone who supported or took part in the annual 5K and 10K run around Verulamium Park on Sunday. Cancer Research UK's Hertfordshire events manager, Courtney Culverhouse, explained, "Life-saving research is being funded right now thanks to people like the women of St Albans who joined the fight at Race for Life. By taking part and raising money, our participants play a crucial role in helping to turn discoveries made in the lab into new, better treatments for patients in Hertfordshire and across the UK. And we'd like to thank everyone who took part in the events at the weekend." She especially thanked all the suppliers and volunteers, including Hertfordshire 4x4 Response, St Albans Air Cadets and St Albans Sea Cadets. Courtney said, "The atmosphere across the weekend was hugely moving, full of emotion, courage, tears and laughter, as people came together to remember loved ones lost to cancer or celebrate the lives of those dear to them who have survived." Race for Life offers a unique opportunity for like-minded ladies to unite against a disease that affects us all in some way. Now we're asking everyone who took part and all the friends, family and colleagues who pledged to sponsor them to return the money they've raised as soon as possible. It is hoped that the event raised at least £100,000 for the charity. Georgie Clark, 21, ran the 5K event on Sunday. She said, "I decided to do Race for Life as it seemed like a fun way for my friends and I to get some exercise and raise money for a very worthy cause. Cancer is something that has touched everyone's lives, and the vibe at the starting line was both emotional and exciting. While the heatwave made training and running slightly more difficult, especially on the hills, no one at the event was fazed, and there was an extremely positive and inspirational feeling amongst the runners and many supporters who cheered them on. Sponsorship money can be paid online, by phone, by cheque, or in person at a Cancer Research UK shop." The article is accompanied by a picture of hundreds of ladies in pink running gear having a wonderful time at the Race for Life.
This article is about the performance of the NHS in Hertfordshire. Healthcare body rated good after major cost savings. The body which funds healthcare in St Albans has improved its NHS England rating from requires improvement to good. In its 2017-18 annual assessment, Harts Valley Clinical Commissioning Group, HVCCG, was commended by NHS England for its financial performance after meeting its statutory financial duties in 2017-18 and planning requirements for 2018-19. HVCCG Chief Executive Catherine Magson says, "This is an excellent result that shows great progress and is a huge testament to the hard work and commitment by our GP membership, clinicians and the wider CCG staff during 2017 and 18. It's a great platform on which to build as we address challenges that remain around urgent and emergency care. Our work to enhance community services to avoid the need for people needing hospital treatment and also to support hospital discharges is critical to sustainable improvement. Delivery of these new community-based services remains a key area of focus for the CCG, and we are already underway with this work, having launched some new services and being in the process of redesigning and recommissioning others. At the same time, we will retain our relentless approach in working with GPs and other providers to make sure we deliver quality care for our patients, including reducing waiting times for treatments while continuing to balance the books. In the 2017-18 financial year, HVCCG made a number of savings, including cutting IVF treatments and the number of prescription drugs and restricting vasectomy and female sterilisation treatments. Other savings introduced are smokers being breathalysed to show they have quit and obese people being required to reduce their weight or body mass index before either of them can have non-emergency surgery. HVCCG Chair Nicholas Small said, "This is an extremely positive report for the CCG. We have worked hard over the past year to strengthen the organisation, and the acknowledgement we have a firm grasp of quality, performance and finance, all underpinned by clear governance arrangements, is very welcome. As well as making sure we continue with our own organisational delivery, we'll also be focusing more in the coming year on working with other organisations across the Hertfordshire and West Essex Sustainability and Transformation Partnership so we deliver as a wider health and social care system, building on the strong engagement and partnership working that is in place." Sustainability and Transformation Partnerships are where the NHS and councils work together on healthcare and social care arrangements. Dr. Small continued, "Given the increasing number of frail patients and people with complex care needs, we all need to work more collaboratively to help people live long, healthy lives and to make sure that services continue to be sustainable." HVCCG has been nominated for a Best Practice Case Study due to its excellent stakeholder feedback, which NHS England said demonstrated strong engagement and partnership working. Chair of the St Albans Patients Group, John Wigley, said, "HVCCG have had to deal with big issues during the last year. They had a programme to trying to reduce expenditure on medicines, which people could get over the counter, rather than being paid for on prescription. That has been a success and not very controversial. But they ran into adverse publicity on the closure of Nascot Lawn, and that was something they did not wish to do. There were financial pressures, and I think they were obliged by NHS auditors to reduce it as it was a discretionary expenditure rather than a necessary one. I think the key difference has been one of internal management inside the CGG under Catherine Magson. As far as I can see, she took quite immediate steps to try and run back unnecessary or perhaps extravagant expenditure. So she introduced a rule that any section which wanted to spend over £10,000 had to be personally approved by her, which was a step in the right direction. The report has recognised her leadership and management skills as she leads from the front, but in a very collaborative way."
Well, news of problems that the heat may have caused. A geologist has warned that the heat wave may cause sinkholes to collapse on land being considered for development. Campaigners Save Simonshide believe the extended drought and low rainfall could destabilise possible sinkholes under greenbelt land near Simonshide, Great Wood. Welland Hatfield Borough Council, WHBC, is currently considering 1,130 houses for this site in its local plan. Evidence of four possible sinkholes, which lie between Wheathamstead and Hatfield, were assessed by geologists from Imperial College London in 2017. The walkover survey found one of the potential sinkholes may be 12 metres wide and made out of chalk. These natural cavities occur when rainwater filters through the ground and erodes the soil, creating natural aquifers or underground reservoirs. If the groundwater level drops in a heatwave or drought, unstable voids open up and the floor becomes in danger of collapsing. Emeritus Professor of Soil Mechanics at Imperial College, John Burland, said, "The land underneath Simonshide Ridge is underlain by chalk, and at least four existing sinkholes are documented on the site. In chalk, sinkholes form over many years by the infiltration of rainwater, causing its gradual dissolution and the creation of cavities. Often these cavities are filled with water and form an aquifer or natural underground reservoir where surface water is effectively stored. When groundwater levels significantly decline, as happens in extended periods of drought, empty, unstable voids can collapse unexpectedly. Geologists found 10 landscape features which indicate sinkholes on the site." He added, "What we are saying is there is strong evidence of sinkhole activity at Simonshide. Activity that we can see at the surface level indicates a strong likelihood of the existence of undetected cavities beneath the ground surface. These cavities destabilise more rapidly in the presence of extreme drought and extreme flooding conditions, the hallmarks of climate change that we are already experiencing." The UK has been in the grip of unexpectedly hot weather for about 2 months now, and St Albans is currently forecast to see temperatures rise to 32 degrees centigrade by the end of the week. Chairman of the Save Simonshide, John Gardner, said, "We have pressed continually for a professional assessment of the sinkholes at Simonshide throughout the local plan process. Evidence that we have presented by well-qualified professionals in this subject had been ignored by the WHBC until we asked the local plan inspector to add our report to the evidence base. We believe that no development on a greenbelt site of similar geology should take place without a professional study of the terrain to assess the risks posed by sinkholes, particularly in the context of climate change and acid rain, which increase the risk of sinkhole formation and collapse." In a report submitted to the WHBC, Save Simonshide said, "Not considering the possibility of sinkholes would call Welland Hatfield local plan into question." It said, "We do not believe that sufficient consideration has been given to this matter in assessing the suitability of the Simonshide site for residential and ancillary development of the kind envisaged, and we've been denied the opportunity to assess whatever evidence the promoters of the site may have on this matter. Unless this matter can be resolved satisfactorily, the soundness of the Simonshide Village proposal must be questioned on grounds of achievability and therefore deliverability." A spokesperson from the WHBC said, "The Save Simonshide group have submitted evidence to the local plan examination on sinkholes in the vicinity of Simonshide. This evidence and the implications for the development of the site are likely to be debated at the hearing session on Simonshide later this year." There's a little note on the end here to say that the Wheathamstead and District Preservation Society recently awarded the Save Simonshide campaign a preservation award.
Teacher runs 60 laps around field for birthday fundraiser. A St Albans teacher ran 60 laps of the school field to celebrate her upcoming 60th birthday and raise money for charity. Carly Thomas, who teaches psychology at Beaumont School, completed the run on Wednesday, July the 11th, in aid of Cure Parkinson's Trust and Music 24, a dementia music therapy charity. She was inspired to take on the challenge after her husband Simon, who has dementia and was diagnosed with Parkinson's 12 years ago, had a near-drowning accident while on holiday in Spain last October. Carly said, "It's been a pretty traumatic year, but it's been pretty tough for the last 10 years or so. I really wanted to do something positive, but I also wanted to celebrate my 60th birthday in a different way. I was a foster child, and my twin sister and I were taken away from my parents before my second birthday. And when I was 5, I was hit by a car. I feel like I've had 54 years extra than I should have had, and I'm just really grateful." Before her 60-lap run, Carly had run a number of half marathons and completed the London Marathon for her 50th birthday, but had not had much practice since her husband's accident. She said, "It was long and it was hot, but it wasn't as bad as some of the other days. It was just great. My daughters and son and different colleagues came and walked part of it while I was running and cheered me on. There was a really good community feeling to it. Since the accident in October, I've not done much exercise. I should have done a lot more. The last 20 laps were pretty hard." So far, Carly has raised nearly £2,000 for both charities. She chose Cure Parkinson's Trust to help fund research into the disease, and Music 24 because of how the charity has helped her husband. She said they still show up at the nursing home and do music with him. "The lovely thing is, for people like my husband, who are so intelligent, he is bilingual and we used to work in South America. He has had such a full life and he was feeling that he couldn't do anything. But the music therapy group was fantastic because they really gave him confidence again. It just really cheered him up." And there's a picture of Carly looking triumphant as she runs her laps around the field.
The next article describes how a London Coney priest has been the victim of extreme trolling after his opinion on shower gel packaging being sexist went viral. Priest and teacher Philip Green, 49, was shopping in Sainsbury's at Coney Fields with his wife and daughters, 13 and 11, when he spotted the Radox products. Angry that only the men's Feel Invigorated product had the branding sporty, heroic, strong and powerful, he tweeted his opinions. The associate priest of St Peter's Church in London Coney wrote, "Hi at Radox UK, for your information, my wife and daughters are sporty, heroic, powerful and strong. Won't be buying your products until the word men is removed from these labels." The Potter's Bar resident then asked Sainsbury's to please stop selling them, followed by the hashtags everyday sexism, these girls can. In contrast, he claims the equivalent women's products were dubbed glam, fabulous, sensational and exotic. Radox UK responded to Philip's tweet, "Apologies if you have taken offence to our packaging. Your opinion as a valuable member of our audience matters to us, and we've passed on your concerns to our marketing and product development team for consideration with future labelling and launches." Since his tweet went viral last week, he has been inundated with cruel comments and insults from online trolls. Mr. Green, who works in a school promoting equality and helping children who have suffered from internet bullying, said his ordeal has been like a slap in the face. People are just sad and have nothing better to do than assume things about me. My daughters have seen these comments, and all I'm trying to do is make sure they grow up in a world where they are treated and seen as equal to men. I find it offensive for women to be seen only in a certain way. Why can't women be seen as strong and heroic as well? Although he has avoided replying to trolls, Mr. Green revealed, "To counter an argument often put forward that I am a self-seeking publicist, a journalist got in touch with me after she saw my tweet. I didn't jump on a bandwagon, other than to use the everyday sexism hashtag, as alleged in some comments." A spokeswoman for Radox said, "At Radox, we always try to design products that clearly explain their benefits and how they make you feel and smell. We have a wide range of products available that can be used by both men and women and that meet a variety of different needs." The article is accompanied by a photo of Philip Green and of the different Radox products that he described.
This next article is about a stellar performance from a young man called Jamie Regan for St Albans Cricket Club. Regan misses out on ton, but knock-in Northwood victory wows Clarence Park crowd. Jamie Regan produced one of the best innings to grace Clarence Park in many a year as St Albans romped to a 5-wicket win over Northwood. The talented 16-year-old will be left to rue just one thing, as he finished on 99 not out. He dominated the latter part of the Saints' innings, having arrived as the number 5 batsman. At that point, St Albans were in a full wobble at 35 for 4, but he and Robert Goddard were able to put on 56 for the 5th wicket to quell the supporters' nerves. The pair rotated the strike well, but when Goddard was stumped for 24, the home side still needed 62 runs from the last 8 overs. However, from that point on, Regan took sole control and blasted 56 of those needed runs. Matt Howson did his best to give the youngster the strike with his running between the wickets, but Regan was in supreme form. He finished the game with a lofted straight 4, and with the very next ball he smashed a 6 to spark wild celebrations. Earlier it had been Simon White who had taken the plaudits. He took 4 for 54 as he ripped through the middle order, including taking the wicket of Sangreet Patel, who had made 77. His successful period came at a time when Northwood had rebuilt following the loss of key wickets. The visiting openers had looked in fine touch, hitting the ball crisply to the boundary multiple times in an opening stand of 76. But the introduction of spin in Mark Telkman, 2 for 21, saw the first breakthrough and he followed with the second 2. That was when Northwood rebuilt again with a partnership of 77 before White returned to turn the tide. The victory was St Albans' 3rd in a row, and it puts them 7th in the Division 2A table with a trip to Basementside Bishop Stortford on Saturday. The second team kept up with the top teams in Division 5A thanks to a 21-run win over London Colney. Batting first, they got to 264 with Harry Seagrave top scoring on 58. And although Colney got close, they were all out for 243 with one over remaining. Seagrave getting 4 for 43 and Charles Smith 4 for 42. The fourths also won, but in dramatic style by just one run against Berkhamsted. Najib Khan got 68 and Andrew Knill-Jones 45, while David Ashton took 3 for 32. The thirds lost by 101 runs.
Crime in the district increases by nearly 20%. With robberies up 116%. Robbery in St Albans has more than doubled in the last year, with overall crime in the district up by nearly 20%. This is according to new data from the Office of National Statistics, which has released crime numbers in St Albans for the year ending March 2018. As well as showing the district's crime has risen by 17% and robberies have risen by 116%, other crimes such as possession of weapons offences and sexual offences have also increased. The figures do not include the total number of burglaries which have taken place in the district in the year ending March 2018, but burglaries have been decreasing in stages since last year. In the year ending March 2017, there were 717 domestic and non-domestic burglaries. In the year ending June 2017, there were 586. In the year ending September 2017, there were 428, and there were only 249 in the year ending December 2017. Shoplifting in St Albans has increased from 813 to 945. But city centre businesses are fighting back with the creation of the Business Crime Partnership, BCP, organised by St Albans Business Improvement District, the BID. BID manager Helen Burridge said the statistics are based on attempted crimes as well as prosecuted crimes, so anything reported through the radio network supported by the BCP will be included. This includes attempted shoplifting and also those that are not escalated by the businesses. In these cases, stock is often recovered and returned to the business. With the expansion of the BCP, we would expect a rise in numbers as more attempted crime is able to be recorded. With this more comprehensive information, businesses and police are better equipped to respond to criminal activity. A crime prevention app called Alert is being included with the BCP membership from this month to support those businesses without a radio. So there may well be a further rise in reporting capabilities in the coming months. Security training sessions and other business initiatives will be available to BCP members later this year to support them to protect their assets. Detective Inspector Alex Warwick said, "While we have seen a slight increase in crime over the last year, this reflects a national trend and can also be a positive indication of more accurate crime reporting and crime recording. In particular, there has been significant increase in dwelling burglary. But equally, we have arrested and locked up a significant number of offenders in relation to these crimes and continue to work hard with both overt and covert patrols to prevent further offences from being committed." While burglaries and vehicle crime figures have overall been high, over the last year we haven't seen a significant increase in robberies, violent crime or sexual offences. Of course, there are incidents, like the short spate of robberies that we had in Harpenden at the end of last year involving young people. We swiftly arrested the offenders and the problem stopped as a result of this positive action. But all these crimes get reported and properly recorded. St Albans and District is still a very safe place to live. Recently, we had two serious knife crime offences in Verulamium Park and in Redbourne, both involving young people, but no significant crimes involving weapons up to March 2018. The figures suggest violent crime involving injury has actually reduced over the last year. An increase in the reporting of sexual offences can be seen as positive, as it means more victims are coming forward who will then receive the specialist support they need. In St Albans, we take all crimes seriously, and I'm lucky to have a great team of detectives who are committed to dealing with a range of crime and will relentlessly pursue criminals. So just to emphasise it, next to a picture of two policemen at work, they've repeated Inspector Alex Warwick's comment, "St Albans and District is still a very safe place to live."
The headline on this next article reads, Does scheme discriminate against women commuters? Thameslink passengers are complaining the lack of extra compensation for Carnet ticket holders is sex discrimination. Govia Thameslink Railway, which runs both Thameslink and Great Northern services, is helping fund a compensation scheme for season ticket holders caught up in this year's timetabling disruption. But the scheme does not include day ticket holders, including people who buy multi-packs of single tickets called Carnet, which has led to complaints of sex discrimination. St Albans commuter and lawyer Isabel Martorell said, "It's indirect sex discrimination because it's having a disproportionate effect on part-time workers, as people who use Carnet tickets do not travel to London 5 days a week and are predominantly women. Under the Equality Act, this comes under the definition of sex discrimination." On the lack of extra compensation for day ticket holders, who have instead been asked to claim under the existing delay repay scheme, Isabel said, "It made me really angry, as it added insult to injury. Working mothers suffer the most from train chaos because we struggle to juggle childcare and making nursery pickups, and now we're being told we cannot get enhanced compensation." She has complained to Govia and also accosted a member of their staff at a Meet the Manager event at London Blackfriars Station, who, when told about the discrimination, admitted nobody had made that point when the scheme was being discussed. A GTR spokesperson said, "The additional industry compensation scheme, which GTR is administering on behalf of the industry, has been offered to customers in agreement with the Department of Transport and in recognition of the recent disruption, for which we apologise. Season ticket holders who bought a ticket for a specific length of time are included in the new compensation scheme because they have experienced lengthy periods of disruption. Carnet tickets, where sold, are available to everyone, irrespective of gender. Therefore, the decision not to include these in the compensation scheme is unlikely to amount to discrimination."
St Albans City Football Club supporters joined a march to Wembley to raise awareness of prostate cancer. The Football March for Men was organised by Prostate Cancer UK on Sunday and saw clubs such as St Albans City FC, SACFC, West Ham and Sutton United marching to the home of English football. SACFC commercial manager Phil Coates, who had surgery to treat this type of cancer in 2014, said, "I'm cycling and walking and even running for Prostate Cancer UK this year because of the help that they gave me back in 2014 and have done since. I want to give something back and encouraged our football team to really support the charity, which they're doing more than ever this year, with 48 riders going to Amsterdam. There's a lot of camaraderie between St Albans fans and fans from clubs all over the area who march together. Walking to Wembley with Jeff Stelling 2 years ago is something I'll never forget. For the first time, the number of men dying from prostate cancer every year has overtaken the number of women dying from breast cancer, making prostate cancer the third biggest cancer killer in the UK behind lung cancer and bowel cancer. Prostate Cancer UK say a man dies from the disease every 45 minutes in the UK. That's unacceptable," says the charity's chief executive, Angela Culhane. "We need to turn that around, and I'm thrilled our walking programme continues to gather momentum and look forward to beating the drum even louder across the UK this year as we mobilise legions of our supporters. Thanks to the money raised, we can fund more groundbreaking research, and it will also help us provide dedicated support and information to men and their families and make prostate cancer a disease the next generation of men need not fear. We've got a way to go, But these walks are the perfect way to take a step in the right direction. Money donated to Prostate Cancer UK will go towards diagnosis, treatment and prevention, and also support and information for sufferers of the disease.
And now an article about cycling in St Albans. 20 MPH road scheme to encourage more cycling. Roads frequently used by cyclists could be restricted to 20 miles per hour under dramatic new proposals. The measure is one of a series proposed by the District Council's Community, Environment and Sport Scrutiny Committee to encourage cycling in the district. Chair Anthony Rowland said, "Cycling is booming in popularity. It is a green form of transport and involves healthy physical exercise. As a council, we must encourage it by creating a safe and welcoming environment for cyclists across the district." The district council is reviewing areas to restrict to 20 miles an hour, including Sopwell and Old London Road in St Albans, and Alexander Road and Manor Road in London Colney, working in partnership with the county council, which is working on a local cycling and walking infrastructure plan. Other suggestions include new cycle paths connected to the Green Ring, a 10-kilometre cycle route around St Albans, and insisting developers pay for all new residential and commercial developments to have good cycling links. The committee's plan was put forward last year, but little was done with it by the council's cabinet at the time. Councillor Rowland said, "A full year has passed since the committee put forward 10 positive recommendations that could pave the way for a cycling revolution in the district. The committee wants to ensure Hearts County Council begins work on a local cycling and infrastructure plan for St Albans as soon as possible. This is an essential step in ensuring St Albans qualifies for funding to continue to develop an infrastructure that enables safe cycling and walking. It is a little disheartening the cycling strategy was not adopted by the council's former portfolio holder, and not all of our proposed measures are progressing yet. The committee felt there is some movement in the right direction, but that our plans need to shift up a gear. We will be expecting further progress in the months ahead." St Albans Cycling Campaign has been working on the strategy with council officers, and the proposals for developers have been included in the draft local plan, which was approved for public consultation earlier this month.
The next article has large photographs with it, and it's Verulamium viewed from a new vantage as a drone snaps images of Roman remains. The architectural outlines of Roman St Albans have been captured in striking bird's eye snapshots of Verulamium Park. When grass in the iconic park becomes parched, the layout of Roman Verulamium is exposed across the dry ground. Commercial drone pilot Robin Hamann has captured the images over the past 2 weeks throughout the summer heatwave. He said, "I can see Roman foundations in Verulamium Park, as well as near the Abbey and over Gorhambury Estate, whenever there is extreme weather. When it snows, the land over foundations melts at a different rate, just as during the summer droughts the grass dries out differently. I've been looking at Roman foundations from above for at least 3 years. I've no idea if these foundations are fully documented." The Marshalswick resident moved from America to England in 1993 and then to St Albans more than 15 years ago. The photographs look more like some sort of parched desert area. It's quite frightening to think it's St Albans Verulamium, and you can quite clearly see the outlines of buildings and roads. Very fascinating.
Performers celebrating AmDram nominations. A local theatre company is celebrating a haul of nominations for major awards. Breakaway Theatre Company has been shortlisted in three of the National Operatic and Dramatic Association, NODA, East District 3, 2017 and 2018 awards. These awards were set up by the East District 3 representative, Nova Hawley, in order to recognise talent around the Harpenden, Redbourne, St Albans, Luton, Dunstable and Bovingdon area. Shelley Healy is up for Best Director for her recreation of the Vagina Monologues. Salima Brohi has been shortlisted for Best Female for her part in the Vagina Monologues. And Danny Smith and Susie Wyeth have been nominated for Best Duo for their depictions of Petruchio and Katharina in The Taming of the Shrew. The Vagina Monologues was only Susie's second appearance with the theatre company, debuting in A Murder Mystery last year. Susie congratulated Shelley on an incredible play. The collection of monologues is so powerful, with everything from people who've gone through gender transition to abuse and rape to people discovering themselves, and the whole piece together was an amazing piece of work, and Shelley is so passionate. I'm really pleasantly surprised that Danny and I got nominated. We had a lot of fun and worked hard in getting the relationship right in two difficult characters, and it was flattering to be nominated. The outdoor Shakespeare production, put on at the Inn on the Park near Verulamium Lake, was long-standing Radio Verulam presenter Danny's debut performance. He said, "I'm thrilled and surprised to be nominated with Susie for such an award. I'm incredibly proud of our work in this, our Shakespeare debut, and I'm grateful for all of the cast and crew for their belief in us. It is truly an honour to be nominated." Winners will receive a certificate at the NODA East District 3 meeting on September the 16th. Nova set up the awards because, as the district representative, I was feeling that there are lots of people who don't get recognition. Breakaway always do great productions, and since I've been doing the awards, they have always figured somehow.
Tributes have been paid to a long-standing swimming teacher who is retiring after decades of service. Valerie Graham Clare taught hundreds of children and adults in St Albans over more than 30 years. First at Swim Gym and then at Strokes Ahead, Sandringham, both held at Sandringham School in Marshalswick. Many of her pupils have become qualified swimming teachers or lifeguards themselves, inspired by her lessons. Valerie's business partner, Jan Morse, is taking over Strokes Ahead for the future. Jan said, "She is absolutely brilliant. She's inspiring and motivational. And she always did the same thing, so you knew what to expect, which is what you need teaching swimming. She is very fair, one of the fairest people I have ever met. Rather than run a business with high profits, everyone got a fair share, and it was more of a cooperative, and it made people want to work with her. She will be missed." Ex-pupils, teachers and parents clubbed together to give Valerie a leaving card and gifts. The article is accompanied by a photo of Valerie with some of her pupils.
And that's the end of the news. Now the list of people whose deaths were announced this week. And it's read by Lizanne.
The three people whose deaths are announced this week are Arnold Burdett, age 74, Roger Crick, and Keith Victor Crosby, age 65.
Now, another little bit of Trombone Hustle by Gothby, and then we'll have our selection of national radio highlights for the next few days.
And now some radio listening that you might like to catch during the week ahead, and we'll start with Saturday, July the 28th. If, with the hot nights, you find yourself waking early at the moment, Try tuning in to Radio 4 at 6:07 to listen to Open Country. This Saturday's programme features the boat builders of Pin Mill in Suffolk. Among their number is Jonathan Gornall, who has twice attempted to row across the Atlantic, but these days he's spending his time building a small sailing boat for his daughter. Helen Mark meets him and the community of boat builders beside the River Orwell. It's summer season, of course, and so, on Radio 2 on Saturday morning, Alan Carr and Melanie Sykes stand in for Graham Norton while he takes a break. Alan and Mel's summer escape has guests, competitions, and a grand day out survey pitting two visitor attractions against each other. The show starts at 10 a.m. and runs until lunchtime at 1 p.m. with lots of laughs along the way. The fun of radio is that dipping into different programmes, you often find yourself learning about someone you've never heard of before, but who has led a fascinating life. E. H. Gombrich could be a case in point. His story is the subject of Archive on 4 on Radio 4 at 8 on Saturday evening. E. H. Gombrich wrote one of the best-known art books of the 20th century, The Story of Art, first published in 1950, and he famously declared that there's no such thing as art, only artists. Ron Newman tells the story of E. H. Gombrich, an Austrian émigré, a man of letters, and the person who first dispatched the news of Hitler's death to Winston Churchill. His granddaughter, Leonie, shares her memories of the man who took the stuffiness out of art appreciation and made it accessible to a wider audience. The story of E. H. Gombrich begins at 8 o'clock on Saturday evening on Radio 4.
Now on to Sunday, July the 29th. And at noon on Radio 3, a very familiar voice to cricket fans will be talking about his musical Private Passions. Blowers, or to give him his proper name, Henry Blofeld, will be choosing his favourite music and talking to Michael Barclay about the difficult decision to end his long innings in the commentary box on Test Match Special, and also his joy at finding love later in life. Private Passions with Henry Blofeld starts at 12 noon on Sunday on Radio 3. The afternoon drama on Radio 4 is a sci-fi classic, To the Ends of the Earth, 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. Jules Verne wrote the novel in 1870, telling the story of a scientist's travels aboard the scientifically advanced vessel belonging to a renegade submariner called Captain Nemo. He's a dangerous man who has turned his back on the human race. That drama starts at 3 p.m. on Radio 4. To round the afternoon off, you could switch back to Radio 3 for The Prom, which starts at 5 p.m. This prom is aimed at introducing the nation's 7 to 14-year-olds to classical music. Not just getting them to listen, but also inspiring them to react creatively to it. The BBC's 10 Pieces project was launched in 2014 and claims to have reached over 4 million people already. But the musical choices for Sunday's prom should appeal to a lot of people, be they young or old. The concert includes Sibelius's Finlandia, Copland's Hoedown, and part of Elgar's Enigma Variations. The prom starts at 5 p.m. on Radio 3.
During the week, from Monday to Friday, there are a number of programmes broadcast at the same time each day. This week, for instance, the Book of the Week on Radio 4, each day at 9:45 in the morning, is Red Thread on Mazes and Labyrinths by Charlotte Higgins. She'll be reading from her book, reflecting on the significance of mazes and labyrinths in art, mythology, literature and life. Later on Radio 4, at 1:45, just after The World at 1, a new series called Unforgettable begins. The idea is that five different people across the week will interact in an imagined conversation with someone who's now dead, with whom they had or would like to have had a connection. On Monday, TV director Jeff Posner, who worked with Victoria Wood on Dinner Ladies and As Seen on TV, tackles Victoria about why she wouldn't let anyone improvise and what her views were on the comparative lack of success enjoyed by female comedians of her generation. The answers all come from past recordings stored in the BBC archive. Other programmes this week feature Adrian Lang talking to his father, the psychiatrist R.D. Lang, and Samantha Roddick talking to her mother Anita, who set up Body Shop, about her environmental legacy that continues through her grandchildren.
Highlights during the week include Natalie Haynes stands up for the classics. Other highlights during the week include Natalie Haynes stands up for the classics on Monday, July the 30th at 4 p.m. on Radio 4. The comedian raises more laughs as she explores the nature of characters from ancient Greece or Rome. On Monday, it's the turn of the Greek courtesan Phryne, no longer a household name, but at one time she was famed for her wit and beauty and notorious for her trial for sexual impropriety. At the same time, 4 p.m, on Tuesday, July the 31st, on Radio 4, Lauren Laverne asks Whatever Happened To. The idea behind the series is that each week Lauren Laverne will reunite three individuals who studied together but then made very different career choices. On Tuesday, three former students of London's Poor School Drama College meet again after more than 20 years. None of them made their way in acting, but they've all forged different, fulfilling career paths. On Wednesday, August the 1st, the historian David Cannadine returns to Radio 4 with a new series of Prime Minister's Props. And on Wednesday, the prop in question is the Duke of Wellington's boot. He must be the only Prime Minister to have a piece of clothing named after him, but it was the Duke's heroic war exploits that led to his custom-made boots becoming items of fashion. At his state funeral, the riderless horse following the coffin had a pair of boots resting in the stirrups. Prime Minister's Props starts at 9:30 a.m. on Radio 4 on Wednesday. Over on Radio 2 on Wednesday evening, starting at 9 p.m, Christopher Biggins celebrates successful double acts. And this week marks the contribution of Elsie and Doris Waters, the sister act who were better known in the 1940s and 50s as Gert and Daisy. The Waters sisters invented a quirky, observational style of comedy, gossiping about their friends, family, neighbours, and anything else that took their fancy. Their chatter went down a storm on the Light programme, and the duo were immensely popular and were still going strong in the 1970s. Classic FM on Thursday, August the 2nd, devotes the Full Works concert to recordings made by the finest young musicians of our time. Among the names you might want to catch is the celebrated cellist Sheku Kane Mason, who was BBC Young Musician of the Year in 2016 and this year had a starring role at the wedding of Prince Harry and Meghan Markle. On Thursday evening on Classic FM, you can hear his recording of Leonard Cohen's Alleluia. The concert starts at 8 p.m. Lastly for this week, a mention for Friday, August the 3rd, when Friday Night is Music Night on Radio 2, starting at 8 p.m. Richard Malcolm conducts the BBC Concert Orchestra and Capital Voices in a 1980s themed evening of music presented by the film critic Mark Kermode. Favourite film themes that will feature include Back to the Future, The Naked Gun, Out of Africa, and Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom.
And now the next in our series of Community Matters interviews. Rob Pearman talks to Ian Murta of The Crescent.
I'm very pleased to welcome to the studio Ian Murta, who is the only full-time worker at The Crescent. You better explain two things, what I mean by full-time worker and what is The Crescent?
The Crescent is a charity supporting people living with HIV, based in St Albans, founded in 1988, First World AIDS Day. Up until 2010, we had a full complement of staff. We had about eight people, our full strength. Now there is only me as the remaining part-timer after our funding cut in 2010, and I have one part-time assistant. My title, I suppose, project manager, cook, cleaner, gardener, anything you like.
But then you don't actually deliver all the services that you provide The Crescent. Does somebody coming to you have to have HIV?
No, we have people that, in fact, we have some people who are being counselled at the moment who have risk behaviours that put them at risk of acquiring HIV, and we're working with them to prevent that happening. For example, they come to us repeatedly testing, and we know that what they're doing is going to result in an infection, so we try and prevent that.
Physically, The Crescent is a building.
Yes.
In St Albans.
Yes, Russell Avenue.
And therefore, you have certain facilities in place there, and people come to you for advice?
Yeah, advice. We have a daily drop-in service that's open access, so anybody can come in during our opening hours throughout the week. We also have appointments at the weekends. They can come to us for advice. For HIV testing, we can send you a test kit by post and pick up condoms. Anything that could be practically considered connected with HIV or sexually transmitted infections, anything of that nature.
If we go back to before you started, well, you presumably weren't there in 88.
No. Joined shortly after, but 92, I think, was my first venture.
But if we go back to the start of The Crescent, that was sometime after AIDS had become a public issue.
Yeah, it's when it was at its peak, really, I think. Yeah. It was starting in 82, the first official diagnosis. A group of local residents concerned about care and support for people living with the condition in the area got together and decided to found this group that would provide some sort of respite, some sort of care advice. At that time, there was no treatment. A diagnosis meant inevitably for very many a death sentence. And so it was just helping people arrange their affairs and deal with the inevitable. It was a very horrible time, really.
Presumably you were working with the health services, local health services.
Yes, the NHS had a facility actually in Russell Avenue where they provided in the community, medical care, and The Crescent was based in Church Crescent around the corner, hence the name, providing the sort of social, emotional and palliative sort of care in the community. In 91, we combined the two services, so they both moved together into Russell Avenue, and as combination therapy started to become available, the effective treatment, the NHS withdrew to the local hospital, leaving The Crescent to run the social care side of things from The Crescent building in Russell Avenue.
So you were seen then as a critical part of the the whole service.
Still are in many ways, because although the medication is still very effective, people's understanding and the stigma that's still associated with it is a real problem for very many people we look after. A lot of them don't tell people that they have HIV. They don't even disclose it to their families, so we're the only people that know. So it can be a very isolating condition for them.
And of course, stigma's been with AIDS right from the beginning, hasn't it? This is a great, enormous panic in California or wherever it was, that it was gay community had created something which was going to decimate the world. It was a plague coming from.
However, it had been around a lot longer than that. I mean, the origins in the Congo and other areas where there have been isolated samples that have identified it going back to the beginning of the 20th century. What used to happen in those instances, in those communities, was that the infection would spread through the community would die out, but because there was no travel between communities, it would end there. And then until the next outbreak, and then much like Ebola and things were contained before, with the development of road travel and air travel in particular, and missionary work in those areas, it began to spread out because people were moving from one place to another. You've got truck routes with people going through and airports with people leaving, and that's how it ended up in places like San Francisco and the like. And the difference being there is it started to affect people who had access to the press, and they had money and they had influence, and so they could make a noise. And so the first instances where people became aware of the condition were because of these people making a noise about it. Hence, everybody assumed that it was just a gay issue. In fact, one of the first names for it was GRID, which was gay-related immune deficiency. AIDS-related complex was another one, and nobody really understood how it was transmitted, but it seemed just to affect that community. After a while, it became evident that it was getting into other communities. Firstly, I think through blood transfusions, because the blood wasn't screened. As we've seen recently, there was still an issue with haemophiliacs in this country who were badly affected through factor VIII, contaminated factor VIII from the States. It was President Reagan's resistance to the idea that created a lot more hysteria. But that's where its sort of origins have lain. And ever since then, we've worked so hard to undo some of that. What compounded the problem was our Don't Die of Ignorance campaign here in the UK. Very effective, because there was no treatment, so people had to be scared to avoid it, which is all well and good. But things have moved on since then, and we haven't had a similar campaign to update everybody. So most people's reference these days, if they're of a certain age like myself, goes back to the Don't Die of Ignorance campaign. So they still think it's a death sentence, and they still think people will be visibly ill, that once you have it, that's your life's over. We still have people who have been tested who come to us thinking, that's it, game over, how long have I got? That's their sort of response.
And you've got people that now that you're working with who are even older than me, probably.
We have now people in their 70s and they're coming up for their 80s who were diagnosed at the beginning of the epidemic, have been living with it for sort of 25 plus years, 30 years. And it's a strange situation to be in, because when we first were sort of created, it was never imagined that people would be able to live that long. A diagnosis at that time usually meant that, unfortunately, somebody wouldn't live longer than 2 or 3 years. A few managed to work their way through it. How was never something you were able to establish. It just seemed so random. But with the advent of proper treatment in the mid-90s, it really changed things, and people we thought were going to die were suddenly back up and walking and healthy again. Now, treatment is so effective, usually one tablet a day is enough to keep someone in an undetectable state, which means they're uninfectious. They can have children, they can do anything they want, and their life expectancy is no different to anyone else. So that's the sort of reality of it today, but the public's perception is still lagging behind, I think.
It's difficult, isn't it? Because we can all remember the impact of the early days, and it was very visible and it was very well defined. It was young, generally young, gay community. And it's not that at all. I mean, it now has spread right across the whole sexual spectrum.
HIV doesn't discriminate. And the issue is not necessarily someone's sexuality or their ethnic origin, although some people are more likely to acquire HIV just because of the prevalence in their community. So if you're someone coming from sub-Saharan Africa, you will be well aware that HIV is a big problem in your continent. You will know about the risks and the issues. Similarly, gay men who have been the sort of focus of the epidemic almost from the beginning know too well all about it. What is lacking is the awareness in the heterosexual community. They seem to think that because a lot of health campaigns are focusing mainly on the at-risk categories, the gay men or the black African, that it doesn't affect them. But HIV infection really is about behaviour. It's not necessarily about your ethnicity or your orientation. A gay man in a monogamous relationship, a black African in a monogamous relationship, are not likely to acquire HIV. But someone who has a different partner on a regular basis, irrespective of their gender, their orientation or their ethnicity, is more likely to acquire it.
And you can have HIV without knowing you've got it. That's
yes.
The trick, isn't
yeah.
it?
Sort of median period could be between 7 and 10 years. And in that time, you'll be incredibly infectious and be more likely to be passing it on. We have a huge problem still in this country. In fact, one of the worst countries for it in the sort of developed world, of people being diagnosed with HIV far too late, far beyond when they should really have been on treatment. That causes issues with their ongoing health. You're more likely to die, 10 times more likely to die in the first year following diagnosis if it's late than if you're diagnosed in time. The cost of treating you is incredibly increased, and you're more likely to have been passing the virus on for longer, so there's more people involved in that particular picture. very often with a late diagnosis, it's not just one person that's diagnosed, it's two or more, because most people acquire it from someone who didn't know they had it in the first place. So it's a growing picture.
You say that people can report too late, but if you don't know you've got it,
yes.
What happened? How do you know?
Well, the thing to do is, if you've never tested for HIV, is to test for it, particularly...
If your life is one that's partners,
yes,
or...
Yes, yeah. If you've changed partners in the last 10 years, then we would advise testing. If you change partners regularly for whatever reason, then test and make sure they test. The sooner you're diagnosed, the better the outcome is. With effective treatment, there is no reason people could not have a decent lifespan, the same as anybody else. They can have children, they can do any job they wish to do. There isn't any restrictions as there used to be.
And somebody who has HIV and their medication, there's no impact on the child?
No, you can have an HIV-free child. The aim of the medication is to bring the virus down to levels that are undetectable. Unfortunately, we can't eradicate it yet. But when it's undetectable, you are uninfectious. You cannot pass it on. But women are now tested antenatally. And so the chances of us now having a situation where people are born with HIV is almost non-existent. The only time it happens is when there's situations where people haven't engaged with mainstream healthcare, when they've had communities dealing with childbirth within themselves, and they're more likely to be the communities that won't reach out for all sorts of reasons rather than just medical ones.
Does every woman know that she's going to be tested antenatally?
They're asked.
Yeah. Okay.
It's discussed with them. Because if they are found to be positive, then they're given a course of treatment and the baby's given a course of treatment after birth, etc. Natural childbirth is now possible, providing it takes place within a reasonable window. If there's any risk of trauma to the baby during the process, then that's aborted and it's a cesarean section. But generally, natural childbirth is possible too. So,
okay, interesting. What is transparently clear is that we're talking here about an issue that affects the whole of our community in different ways, or potentially, and it's not a narrow, small spectrum that somehow...
No, indeed not. No, it's only when you get involved with it that you realise how far it reaches into our community. In the 25 plus years or so I've been with the Crescent, I've seen quite a bit and come across, there isn't really now much that shocks me or I'm surprised about. The biggest problem is people's assumption that it won't affect them. If we could get across to people that it will infect and affect anybody, and that it's not the death sentence it was, that you can live with it and it's perfectly acceptable, and it's not because you've been bad, naughty or behaved in a certain way, it's you've just been unlucky. It would be better for all of us, because then we would have more people testing. I think the reason that people don't come forward and get tested is not because they're worried about testing or the process itself, it's the fear of what comes after. I mean, most people are used to the test for HIV, the instant test, for example, is just a finger prick. It's like a diabetic blood sugar test. And you get the result in 60 seconds, there and then. So most people can cope with that, I think. The reason I think people don't come forward for testing is they think, well, if I do find out about it and I have got it, then my life's over. And that is the biggest hurdle we've still got to overcome.
Yes, because come back to what you said before, the sooner it's detected, the longer...
Yeah.
Normal life.
The better your health outcomes are going to be, and the less chance you have of passing it on, because once you're on the treatment and it's brought your levels down to undetectable, then you can't pass it on. So it's better all round. You know, better to know than not.
So there's two, in a sense, I'm sure this is simplifying, there's two aspects to what the Crescent is trying to do. One is to provide a support and counselling service, or a range of services. The other is communication, is that
right? Yes, yeah, to try and raise awareness. We have a lot of awareness work. We're going to schools and universities. We provide placements for university students, particularly in healthcare and social work and those sort of fields, so that we can get the word out and educate another generation so that they come forward with not only the information that they need to avoid acquiring HIV, but also to educate others. So we're sort of sending out a message like a ripple, because that's the only way we're going to overcome it. The more people that can do it, the better.
And when you go into schools, effectively you leave behind a message, but do you leave anything else behind? And I don't necessarily mean something like a leaflet or stick up on the wall or something, but does anybody in that school then say, this is something that's important, we have to carry on with this information? Does it get absorbed into the curriculum?
Yes, generally. If the school are open and accepting of the situation. As we know with SRE, sometimes that's a difficult subject for some schools to tackle. But generally, yes, and we get to go back on a repeated basis and see another generation of students, another class of students. Same with universities. We're sort of regularly at Oakland's dealing with people there to try and raise...
Are you just covering the sort of the St Albans district? Is that your remit, or do you go way beyond that?
We have members from as far away as South London. We've even got some who now only by internet means, but they're up in Dumfries. We've got people over Northampton Way.
Is that because there simply aren't enough places of the equivalent of the Crescent, or historical reasons?
There is, unfortunately, along with the current theme of austerity, loads of our counterparts are closing because they can't overcome the devastating financial cuts that they've received. We're fortunate in the fact that I've managed to, I think, wring every penny out of every one of my friends to keep the place going. And we've had some wonderful support from the people of St Albans, who've just been fantastic. And without them, we wouldn't be here. And I don't think in many areas they have that much local support. So we are picking up people from other places because there isn't what we offer elsewhere.
Just come to that offer, just to clarify, and we haven't got enough time to go through all the services, but in summary, you've used terms like advice, counselling, guidance. How can you summarise the services that you offer?
Well, it's sort of like a whole person package. If you imagine HIV affects every aspect of your life, then there is every aspect of a Crescent service that helps with whatever that may be it employment, be it your own physical or mental well-being, be it with your relationships, etc., etc. So... if you can imagine it, it will affect a diagnosis. And it's not only the person living with the condition, it's their family, their friends, and we support them as well as a unit. If they've got other health conditions, we'll aim to help with those, because anything that makes their life more bearable then makes them able to cope with their diagnosis better. So it's really a sort of whole person service. Whatever's wrong, we'll try and help with.
And apart from that aspect of guidance and counselling, and you're dealing with a whole range of different things there, you go into schools, so that's the education, the communication, universities. What else do you
do? We have social groups, we have peer support, for example. We are an organisation that is run by and for, so the majority of our board are people living with HIV or have been affected by it, either lost somebody to it or know someone living with the condition. And that's the same for our staff too. So therefore we are in a position to work out and design services that will best meet the needs of the people we're seeking to help. People within the organisation, we call them members, not service users, we don't like that term at all, can vote, can become board members, can actually help design the service too. But the main focus is to bring people together so that they can share and support one another. Peer education, peer support is sort of like the core of our operation. So we have social groups. We've just had a lunch. We have a monthly lunch on a Sunday where everybody gets together. And sometimes the conversations have absolutely nothing to do with HIV. It's just people relaxing and being themselves.
Because they feel in a safe environment.
Yes, very often they're going through life I was trying to describe it as a life within a life. They have an outer shell which the world sees. And inside is the real person that doesn't come out until they're in a safe environment. And once they're in that Crescent building, that cover comes off and they can just be, you sort of see them relax and sigh and then everybody sort of gets together. There's always lots of laughter. It's not a miserable environment by any means. We do have our down periods and people are upset, but everybody pulls together to bring them up. It's just one of the beauties of the place, I think.
And you talk about these various services and all these different things that you do. You can't do it all yourself. You're the only full-time employee. There must be other, you said volunteer. Everybody else volunteers?
Yeah, we have some volunteers. We have members who are volunteers. Majority of our people work, so the volunteering activity tends to be sort of concentrated on our weekend stuff. Anything that goes on during the week is me, so I'm 24/7. I'm over hopeful that we'll get to a point where we can raise enough money not just to keep our doors open, but to enable us to employ another that will spread the load a little bit, because sometimes it does get a bit hectic.
But if you're providing counselling services and therapies of various sorts, you must use professionals.
Yes, for counselling we have two volunteer counsellors and a paid counsellor, and we have a paid complementary therapist we bring in for the therapies for whether it's side effects of medication or whether they have a comorbidity like arthritis or something like that. Medication does come with sometimes, although increasingly less these days, sometimes initially you have an issue with perhaps nausea or lack of sleep and stuff like that, and things like acupuncture and massage can help with that greatly.
So you can provide a package of around the situation. And is that sort of, you model it to each individual? I mean, each individual situation is different.
Everybody's situation is different. Everybody's life is different. And the way HIV affects them generally can be very different. So we try to assess the person and ask them pertinent questions and try and design a sort of care package that best suits them. Whether that be counselling, whether that be therapies, whether that just be having someone to talk to about it, or knowing that there is support there, because often it's very lonely. We don't discharge anybody. People leave the Crescent. Sometimes we don't see them for another year or two, maybe five, and then all of a sudden they'll walk through the door because something has occurred, because the condition fluctuates, because situations, people's lives change. People get involved in new relationships. They don't know whether to tell the person straight away or whether to wait a while, etc. All of these things come up.
Can somebody come to you first, as it were, via the internet or via other resources?
Yeah, they can walk in, they can be referred by their GP, they can call us, they can email us. We've got a range of social media options, so there's many places for people to
and telephone as well, obviously.
And telephone, yes, all the traditional methods.
You're dealing with something which comes out of a background of stigma. You've got people who are cautious about their revelation to their friends and family.
Yeah.
Confidentiality is a big issue?
Yes, incredibly. Trust and confidentiality. I think that's one of the reasons that we've been so successful in helping so many people is we try and maintain some level of continuity. Even when we lost our funding and we lost the staff, the people that are still working with us as volunteers, as therapists and everything are all the same people. The worst thing for someone to do is to get to a situation where they've got to talk about their own story, however it occurred, whatever has happened to them in their life, and then the next week or the next month have to say it again to somebody else, and then again and again. And in the end, they get tired of telling people and they just won't talk. So the fact that they've got someone they know they can come to that knows their background, knows their issues, is a great benefit to them. I think, and that's something that with the restructuring of many social care environments needs to be taken into consideration, because nobody likes to go through the trauma of everything over and over again just because that person that was here last week has now gone and we've got another person in.
And there's no good relying upon a record that's brought into a computer.
No. Notes are all very well and good, but they don't create the emotion or convey the seriousness of something. And of course, notes are only as good as the person who's left them.
You said that you've had a lot of support from the local community in terms of fundraising. I guess you need quite a bit of money to keep this going.
Yes. We're fortunate in the fact that we own the building, so we don't have to find rent. But running the operation to a reasonable standard and providing as many of the services as we can usually costs us between £4,000 and £5,000 a month. Now, I've been raising that more or less on my own for 7 years now, and it's incredibly difficult. There is a number of charities that have been very kind to us, and we've been successful with a number of grants, but they're mainly for projects, specific activities like for counselling, etc. One charity, Hearts Community Foundation, have just helped us with our counselling costs. But for the core running costs, for the gas, the water, the electricity, the insurances and things, that is incredibly difficult to find money for. We were always very, very aware and very grateful for the support of the cathedral too, because each year they provide us with some funding right at the very point we need it. The beginning of the year is always a very low point for us, and that's also when our insurances, our contracts, everything renews, and so you've got big outlay all in one go. And trying to get that funding from an external source is nigh on impossible. Everybody seems to want to fund the outside of the cake, the icing, but not the actual... the base of it, the cake itself, it's very difficult, very, very difficult.
You could do some big bequests.
Yes, yes. Every time I think we've got to the point where we can't go on any longer and that I've used every get-out-of-jail-free card that I might have possessed and rinsed every single friend of mine for every last penny that they could possibly give me, something turns up. So I live in a perpetual state now of hope. I used to get very despondent and think, there isn't really much hope, this is all going to fall apart. But now I've been through that cycle so many times, I just get, we're here again, okay, just sit tight. There are times when we run critically low on funds and we have to withdraw from what we're doing and just concentrate on our real core activity and just provide a drop-in and an advice service and basic testing services and stuff until something else comes in. And then when the money rolls in again, we then expand and go back to what we're doing. It'd be nice not to do that, but it's the way we have to work. Often you're faced with a choice of which bill do I pay first, but we seem to get through it.
And in a sense, the elephant in the room is the fact that you've had your principal grant withdrawn. I mean, the local authority grant has gone.
Yes, that went in 2010.
And that was a big hit.
Yes. At full strength, we were funded in the region of about £190,000 a year. That went overnight because we were part funded by NHS Hertfordshire and Hertfordshire County Council, and the two were linked. There was a joint commissioning partnership arrangement. So when one stopped, so did the other. We had some reserves, so we managed to function for a while after that, but then because we'd had staff, again, because of the continuity thing, we'd had staff that had been with us many years, we had obviously their redundancy issues to deal with. So we tried to do that in as kind and as an appropriate manner as possible, which then left us in a situation where we had but a few pounds, really. And my mother, who was working with me at the time, and I sat there and thought, well, what do we do? Because we still have people coming through the door. We've still got the same number of people we're trying to help. It doesn't seem that they're going to be able to use the replacement service. As part of the process, we had to survey our members to ask them if they wanted to transfer their information to the other charity on the other side of the county. And I think, I can't remember the exact figure, some 97% of those that responded said, no, can you please try and find ways of staying open? The other 3%, I think, already used the other service anyway, so it was no difference to them whatsoever. Unfortunately, or fortunately at that time, my grandmother had passed. She was a St Albans resident for many years and had left me some money. And we discussed the whole situation because it was all looming around the time that she was unwell. And she'd left me some money. And together, mother and I, we blundered on with that money, paying the basic bills, kept the place going for a couple of years. There was not much money for anything else, including us, until I could sort of get together a reasonable fundraising strategy and had managed to get a few people to come on board and help. And we slowly picked ourselves up from there. So we have limped along in that fashion, and I think last year was just over 80,000 we raised. It works, but it's fingernail-biting stuff.
You'd
really
rather not spend all your time trying to raise money.
Yeah, because that then impacts on the amount of time I've got available to help people.
That's right. So what gets you going on this every day? How do you drive yourself?
Because my partner was positive. My partner didn't survive. I saw how horribly people were treated. I've experienced it firsthand myself. I had an employer insisting that I test just because I volunteered at the Crescent at the time. So I know how awful it can be for people and how that puts you in a situation where you don't know where to turn. Fortunately, I knew better than they did and was able to handle the situation. But if I were living with a condition and had been put in that spot, I think I would be horrified, petrified, and really, because the thing just rolls on once one person knows, another person knows, and then the thing gets out of control and you have no way of stopping it. And it can really, it has wrecked people's lives. Perhaps at that time it was the very worst of the epidemic, sort of the late 80s. People were just ostracised, just even on the suspicion, not even with the knowledge of whether they were HIV positive or not. So that's what got me involved in the first place. And then the cuts that came in 2010, and looking and thinking, well, where are these people going to go? It's not like they can come forward themselves and make themselves known, because by virtue of doing that, they're then disclosing the very thing they were trying to hide effectively. So someone had to do it. I was always taught, I was brought up to protect those that couldn't protect themselves. And so I've sort of stuck to that, and that's what keeps me going. You get bad days and you get wonderful days when someone sends you a thank you card through the post and you know you've made a real difference, you know, and you can see people coming in with the world's weight on their shoulders, and a few months down the line you can see them, they're lighter, they're lit, and they're moving, they've got their head up again, and that's what keeps you going. There are lots of disappointments, of course, and lots of things that don't go quite as we expected, but on the whole, that's what keeps me going.
Just before we finish, we're talking about the work of the Crescent now, because it's just about coming up to an anniversary for the Crescent and for
World AIDS Day. Yes, World AIDS Day is the 1st of December. We were founded on the 1st of December, the very first World AIDS Day in 1988. So it's our 29th birthday this coming December. It's also National HIV Testing Week from the 19th of November. But yes, HIV and its associated causes will all be in the press around this period. We're going to be down at the City Station waving and trying to give out ribbons to raise awareness. So, important day for us. One day when we can acknowledge not only that the issue still exists, but also remember those that we've lost to it.
Thank you very much, Ian.
My pleasure.
Finally, we have our piece of music, Trombone Hustle by Goffby, in its entirety. Many thanks to all our readers today. To Lizanne and Alex for stepping into the breach to produce this programme for me. To Monty and John, who make all the copies of the programme and arrange to get yours to you. We'll be back again next month. But that's all from News Extra in July 2018. Goodbye.